Scamming 101, How to Avoid Getting Conned. Frank Abagnale knows a thing or two about fraud. He became a master con man as a teenager, posing as an airline pilot, a doctor, and a Harvard-educated lawyer. Abagnale was eventually caught and sent to prison, but turned his experience into a career as a security consultant, working closely with the FBI. His exploits are depicted in the film Catch Me If You Can. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Frank Abagnale about his story and about how he helps consumers avoid becoming the victims of fraud. We'll also talk with Maine Attorney General Janet Mills about the state's efforts to stop perpetrators of scams. We're live from Hannaford Hall at the University of Southern Maine in Portland as part of AARP's Fraud Watch Network. Maine Calling helps you stay one step ahead of the scammers. First, this news. From Hannaford Hall at the University of Southern Maine, this is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. I'm Keith Shortall. Every hour of every day, someone somewhere is the victim of a scam. It might be a complex internet-based phishing scheme or the work of an experienced con man. Today we're going to learn how to spot scams. My guests today know a lot about fraud detection and prevention. Janet Mills is Maine's Attorney General and helps lead the fight against scammers. Frank Abagnale is an identity theft expert. Between the ages of 16 and 21, he successfully posed as an airline pilot, an attorney, a doctor, and cashed millions in fraudulent checks. His exploits were depicted in the movie Catch Me If You Can, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. For over 40 years, he's advised the FBI on how to outsmart con artists. He's one of the world's most respected authorities on forgery, embezzlement, and secure documents. And now he's joined forces with the AARP Fraud Watch Network to help people learn how to spot and avoid scams. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you been the victim of a scam? What do you do to protect yourself and your family from fraud? Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to Maine Calling. Janet Mills, we'll start with you. How big of a problem is scamming in Maine? Is it on the rise?
Definitely. Keith, thanks for the question. It's a pleasure to be here today. We get about 12,000 calls in our office just last year alone from consumers on a great variety of matters, but more and more frequently those calls concern, those emails concern scams. Somebody's been deprived of their money, somebody wired money to somebody they didn't know and then decided to ask questions about it, and we try to help them. We had mediations in about 1,000 cases last year involving smaller matters, but we do a lot with the FTC. We coordinate with the Department of Justice on some major cases, and we try to put a stop to these scams, but it's really, really important to prevent it from happening in the first place. It's extraordinarily difficult to investigate these cases with a new voice over internet protocols, new ways of disguising your phone number and pretending to be somebody from the IRS or the Attorney General's office even or the police department. Scammers and phishers, P-H-I-S-H-E-R-S, are taking money from people every day. And, you know, we have a graying state, as you know, a fair percentage of people who are seniors living alone in their homes, still have landlines perhaps, or not terribly used to a computer. They get taken advantage of, and I think our state's being picked on probably more than any other state. You look at the reports of the Committee on Aging, and you'll see that a great number of the complaints they developed were from the state of Maine. And what bothers me as a public official, too, is that hundreds of thousands of dollars is leaving this state every year. Money that should stay at home, should be used to help your family, used to support law enforcement, health care, education here in the state of Maine.
So how do these work? Is there a recent example? I know they change over time, but do you have a recent...
Well, funny you should ask, Keith. Just yesterday, I was apprised that my own photo on Facebook was being taken and misused by some scam artist in New York State and used to solicit money from innocent people who had no idea. Well, they even misspelled my name, so go figure. But we got a call from somebody in New York State saying, my daughter got this this solicitation for money and saying that if she just sent $500, you, Janet Mill without an S, would send her $300,000. And we said, don't do it. It's not me, and I wouldn't do that anyway. So, and that's happened before. Public officials get their photos stolen, misused, transposed, et cetera. So we've shut that down, and we're investigating that. That's just a recent example. The grandparent scam is a big one.
The grandparent scam is the one where you get a call. The elderly people get a call, and the scammer says, "Hi, I'm the constable here in Canada, and I've got your grandson. What's his name again?" And the grandparent says, "Oh, Jimmy, is that Jimmy?" And and that praise, I guess, leverages the concern and fear of the grandparent to do whatever it takes to get to.
Very sophisticated scam. I had a letter from a former representative who served with me, a very well-educated person, who gave me this long letter, wanting me to know that this is happening to all kinds of people in the state of Maine. And they lost several thousand dollars before somebody at the CVS or the store where they were going to send another sum of money said, don't do it, don't do it. It's a scam. So we're working with the companies that wire money and the banks and others to try to red flag these cases where a person tries to, wire money to a foreign address with no good reason.
And we'll have tips on how to avoid this and how to spot it. But I want to bring Frank Abagnale in. And I wonder if you'd share some of your story, too, which is so interesting. It begins at a very young age. You're a teenager. Your family's in disarray. Your parents are getting divorced. And you essentially run away from home at the age of 16. And part of the way that you survive is to begin learning how to con, how to write bad checks, but also to be people that you aren't. And in one instance, you come across a pilot at a hotel, and this sort of you have a vision of what potential that might have. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I ran away back in the late 1960s. I was 16 years old. Ended up on the streets of New York City. Back then, a lot of young people in the 60s got involved in Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, the drug scene. Instead, I ended up trying to survive, and so I realized right away that I had to make people believe I was a lot older than 16. So I had a driver's license at 16. It was back then no photo on it, just an IBM card, so I altered one digit of my date of birth. I was actually born in April of 1948. I changed it to 38. That made me 10 years old or 26 years old. I started writing checks to support myself. I found it very easy to go in and get people to cash checks. It's true, I did see an airline crew come out of a hotel. Then I realized if I had that uniform, it would make it a lot easier to cash checks, which led to me riding around on airplanes. I impersonated a doctor in a Georgia hospital for a while. I passed the bar in Louisiana, practiced law there for about a year. I wrote about $2.5 million worth of bad checks till I was apprehended at 21 by the French police. And in France, I served time in the French prisons, later extradited to Sweden, served time in the Swedish prisons, and later brought back to the United States and convicted in federal court and sent to 12 years in federal prison. I served four of those 12 years at a federal prison in Virginia. When I was 26 years old, the government offered to take me out of prison on the condition I go to work with an agency of the government for the remainder of my sentence or till my parole had been satisfactorily completed. I agreed. This year I'm celebrating 41 years at the FBI. I've been there for over four decades. I've spent most of my 40 years dealing with crimes against federal government agencies, state governments, county governments, city governments, as well as financial institutions and corporations. All the books I've written, all the lectures I've given are all related to business-to-business crimes. And about 3 years ago, AARP contacted me and said, we'd really like you to go out and educate consumers, everyday people, not only elderly people, everyday people who are losing their life savings and money from these scams. We know you're familiar with these scams and how they work, but we'd like you to go out and talk about it. So I thought that would be great. It's towards the end of my career. I thought it'd be great to do some things that actually help an individual on the street. So this is my third year touring for AARP. They take me to 12 cities a year. I work with their Fraud Watch Network to help them develop programs and stay ahead of the scams so they can help educate people on the street. And tonight we'll do just that. I'm a true believer in my 40 years of doing this that education is the most powerful tool to fighting any type of crime, and especially consumer crime. The truth is the majority of Americans are honest, but because they're honest, they don't think in a deceptive way. So when they get that call on their caller ID and it says Internal Revenue or Portland Police Department, they believe that's who's on the phone. And so when you teach them that's not necessarily the case and you explain to them what to do, they're smart enough to do that.
One of the skills, aptitudes that you had early on, you discovered was the ability, for example, to walk into a bank in Manhattan and get a check cashed. This amazed some of your friends who said, I couldn't do that. What was the skill that you had? You had a personality that made people comfortable enough to trust you and have confidence that you were who you were. Was that a powerful part of?
I think the most powerful, people always say you were a genius, you were brilliant. I don't think that was the case. I think what it was is I was an adolescent who had no fear of being caught, really had no fear of the consequences. So to be honest with you, I never premeditated anything I did. So if I stood in front of the bank with a $500 check, I didn't say to myself, okay, I'm going to walk in, here's my plan, I'll say this, but if they say this, I'll do this. I just simply walked in and did it. It was the same way with the airline pilot. I only saw the uniform as a means of, now when I walk in the bank, I'm this respected airline pilot, I'm from out of town, I'm short of cash, this is back before ATMs, debit cards, and can you cash a check for me? Which the uniform was amazing. It was the difference between night and day. They just immediately said yes because all they saw was the uniform, and I saw the power of the uniform. Then I remember walking out to the TWA terminal at JFK to buy a ticket, but I was in the uniform, and the ticket agent said, are you riding or are you buying? I said, I beg your pardon? Are you flying the jump seat for free or are you buying a ticket? I said, no, I'm riding the jump seat for free. So everything I did, I learned. I was more of an opportunist than anything else, but I don't think it was a matter of brilliance. It was a matter of being so young. I always believed had I been a little older, I would have rationalized all these things and said, it'll never work, they'll never believe me, and I would have never got away with it.
But even the story of how you got the uniform illustrates how you were able to use your wits to convince a savvy adult that you could have this uniform.
And I remember just walking up to a payphone, and right in front of me was the Pan Am building, and so I called Pan Am's corporate headquarters, and I thought of this just as I was doing it. I didn't know what I was going to say. The switchboard answered, and I hesitated a moment, then I asked if I could speak to someone in the purchasing department. The clerk came on, and I said, yes, I'm a pilot with Pan Am, been with the company 7 years. I've never had this happen before, but we flew in here yesterday. I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry clean. Now the hotel and the cleaner said they can't find it. I have a flight in about 4 hours. How do I get a new uniform? He asked me if I had a spare uniform. I said, yeah, back home in San Francisco. So he said, well, this is going to cost you the price of a uniform. So I said, that's fine. So he said, you need to go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. They'll take care of you. Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know. So I went down to the well-built uniform company. They fitted me out in the uniform. I remember the gentleman, I said to him, how much do I owe you? He said, well, it's $245. I said, no problem. I'll write you a check. He said, no, I can't take any checks. I said, oh, well, then I'll just pay you cash. No, I can't accept cash. You need to fill out this computer card. Then in these boxes, put your employee number. And we build this back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next paycheck. I said, oh, that's even better. And that's how I got there.
I just want to continue one more step in the story before we get back to the frauds that we're talking about today. You also needed an employee pass or an ID, a placard of some sort for the airline. Tell us how you came about getting that.
Well, same thing. I kind of realized very shortly that the uniform alone was not going to get me on any planes. So I decided that I needed to have a Pan Am identification card. I didn't know how I would go about doing that, but I started to make phone calls. And finally, one company said to me, you know, most of those airline IDs are made by Polaroid or 3M company. So I finally went down to the 3M company in Manhattan. I called, said I was a purchasing agent for one of the major airlines. We're looking to change our identification system, go to a more formal ID. So when I got there, the guy opened the book and he said, oh, we do Braniff Airlines, National Airlines, Eastern Airlines, Pan Am. I said, yeah, we like this Pan Am format, but I wonder if you have a sample I could bring back. And he said, sure. And he brought me back actually a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card blown up in the middle of it. Someone else's picture in the ID, a John Doe for a name, and in bold red ink across the front, this is a sample only. And I said to him, no, this won't do. I said, actually, what is all this equipment on the floor? Oh, no, we don't just sell this card. We sell the system, camera, laminator. So we have to buy all this. Absolutely. But there wasn't to buy it. I wanted to just demonstrate how it works and use me. So he took my picture and made up the card. But when I was going down the elevator, it was a plastic card like a driver's license would be today. But there was nothing on it said Pan Am. No corporate logo, no name. It was a plastic card, so you couldn't type on it, you couldn't write on it, you couldn't print on it. So I was kind of discouraged. I put it in my pocket, headed back to the hotel. And I had passed a hobby shop. So I walked in and asked them if they sold models of commercial airplanes. They said yes, and I bought a model of a Pan Am cargo jet, took it back to my room, threw all the parts out, but there at the bottom of the box were the decals that went on that model. And the little Pan Am globe that would have went on the tail of the plastic plane went perfect up at the top of the plastic card, and the word Pan Am and the special styling of graphics that would have went on the fuselage went perfect across the top of the card and had a perfect Pan Am identification.
I think we're giving too much information here. Somebody at home might think they can still do this.
Well, but it does illustrate, though, that you know to what lengths scammers, fraud, perpetrators of fraud will go and the ingenuity that they have to get money from people.
Absolutely. And what's so most amazing to me today at, I'll be 69 years old in about a week or so, what's most amazing to me today is that what I did some 50 years ago is 4,000 times easier to do today than when I did it because of technology. I didn't have all of the technology that criminals have today. So, for example, making an airline identification card could be done simply at home with a laptop and a printer, and you could make a very significant-looking identification card. So those things didn't exist back in my time. So it's amazing that you would think it would be more difficult to do, but it's actually more easy to do.
And Janet Mills, you said in your early comments that technology was also really fueling this explosion.
It's our friend and it's our foe. Yeah. You know, people who get on the internet and you get a strange email from somebody or a Facebook message from somebody soliciting something, or some of the scams, the grandparent scam is one, the lover scam, you know, is another one where people are lonely and they want to match up with somebody in some other country, some other state. And these scams go on for months and months. And we just got a couple calls yesterday in our office where a person was ready to sell their house and dispose of the proceeds, give it to somebody they had never met in person, and on the reliance of the other person's sophisticated come on over the internet and by telephone, that this was true love and this was going to be the person of her dreams. And whoa, this happens a lot more than we'd like to think. And it's very sad. People have lost tens of thousands of dollars, if not more. And so technology and technology that allows a person to disguise their phone number and take over somebody else's accounts. And you never know, that it's phishing. It's not real. But the IRS will never call you at home and send a police officer after you or threaten to arrest you in the way that these calls are coming into us now. The Portland Police Department is not going to call you and threaten to arrest you because you didn't make bail or pay a fine. My office isn't going to do that, but those are the things to watch out for.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls and questions and comments. We're talking about fraud and scamming and how to prevent it. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the American Lung Association, thanking the 750 volunteers who make the trek across Maine possible. Learn more at biketreknewengland.org.
A small-town lawyer's mother prodded him into taking on pharmaceutical distributors.
She made some offhand comment to the rest of the family that somebody in our community should do something about it, and That's when one of my brothers looked at me and said, isn't that what you do for a living?
I'm Kelly McEvers, how West Virginia counties are going after one link in the deadly opioid chain. This afternoon on All Things Considered.
All Things Considered gets underway this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
The news keeps on coming. The issues seem to compete with one another in terms of importance and relevance to our lives. Where do you turn to stay in touch, keep on top of things, have a better understanding of everything that's going on? No doubt, among your choices, right here, Maine Public Radio, and probably as much, if not more, than ever. Hi, Charles Beck here. This listener-supported service is dedicated and determined to provide you with unbiased, in-depth, non-commercial, non-sensational reporting, a trusted source for news, information, and public affairs in your life each and every day. On just one day, Super Thursday, April 27th, please do your part and call or pledge online with your financial support to ensure this service is here for you and others in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks.
Super Thursday is next Thursday, April 27th, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the programming, Fighting Back Against Fraud. We're broadcasting live from Hannaford Hall at USM. With me today, Janet Mills. She's the Attorney General for Maine. And Frank Abagnale is also with us. He's an identity theft expert. Between the ages of 16 and 21, he successfully posed as an airline pilot, an attorney, and a doctor, and cashed millions in fraudulent checks. For over 40 years, he's advised the FBI on how to outsmart con artists. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I know you each have your list of things to do, how to respond, and how to spot fraud, Janet, but we'll start with you. Give us a few tips, I guess, on how to avoid being victimized by some of these scams.
Sure. First of all, the phone. You don't have to answer the phone when it rings. There are thousands of phone calls being made. I get them at work, and I get them at home from fraudsters. It's good to wait to see who's calling you. If you recognize the number as your friend or relative, then answer. But otherwise, put it into the message machine and then verify that it's somebody you really know. The idea of spoofing callers is prominent now and prevalent. And it's dangerous to pick up the phone and get somebody who you don't really know, and they pretend to be somebody else like the IRS, and you think you can play along with it, even if you recognize it as a scam. Don't play along with it. If you answer the phone, don't press 1, don't press any numbers. Hang up, because once they know they have a person on the other end of the line, they will keep you going, and then they will call you back. And they're very persistent, very aggressive, very nasty. Same thing with emails. You get emails you don't recognize, and even if they look like your bank or your vendor, but they're not, delete them. So that's the best advice I can give to prevent yourself from being scammed.
Frank, you also have a list for helping people protect their identity. One of those is credit protection. Is that a service you buy, or explain that?
I do a few things. First, I only use a shredder that is a micro-cut shredder, which turns paper into confetti or the size of a piece of rice. Straight shredders and crisscross shredders can all be put back together again, so you're kind of wasting your time shredding it. Second, I don't write a lot of checks, because every time you write a check and hand it to a clerk, you've given them a piece of paper, your name and address, phone number, your bank's name and address, your account number at that bank, your routing number into that account, that's your wiring instructions, your signature on the signature card at your bank, and then the clerk has written down your main driver's license number and your date of birth. We don't get that check back because we live in truncation, so we only get an image of that check. The physical check goes and eventually is destroyed, but anyone who would see the face of that check could access your bank account, order checks off your account, or et cetera.
And now, but now you can also, as a convenience, take a picture of a check with your phone and send that electronically to a bank. Isn't that a chance to intercept that?
Yes, and that remote debit capture allows somebody to actually get a paycheck today, deposit it in their account by remote debit capture on their phone, but then go down the street and cash it. So someone's going to be out some money somewhere. So I don't know who thinks up these ideas, but they must have lobbyists in Washington that work in their favor to help them pass some of these things. And the final thing is, I don't own a debit card. I've never owned one. I have three sons. I've never allowed them to have one. I like to simply use the safest form of payment that exists on the face of the earth, and that is a credit card, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover card. Every day of my life, I literally spend their money. I don't spend my money. And when I use my credit card, I will do everything to make sure nobody gets the number. But if they do, and tomorrow they charge $1 million on my credit card, by federal law, I have zero liability. I have no liability. So I use a credit card to buy things online, especially when I go overseas. When you use a debit card, every time you take it out of your wallet, you're accessing money in your account. So if I get it, I'm stealing money out of your account. Then you have to try and get that money back and put back into your account. Now, you could use your debit card for the next 20 years 10 times a day, and you will not raise your credit score by a half a point. So when you use your credit card and you pay the bill, part of the bill, your credit score goes up. So that helps young people build credit. A lot of young people only use a debit card, have no credit, because they haven't done anything to build their credit up. So I found using a credit card to pay my payments is the safest way, whether I'm buying something online or I'm buying something in a store or I'm traveling overseas.
ATMs, we hear, look out for buggers or bugged keypads or skimmers, but how do you look out for that? Are they visible?
Well, we had a 157% increase in ATM scams at banks that are on bank property or in the drive-in of the bank. These are usually with clone cards that someone has created from a breach, maybe. We've also had more than 340% increase on machines that you find sometimes in a hotel lobby that have no affiliation to a bank. And the truth is, I have gone into a lot of hotel lobbies where I purposely look behind those machines to see if they're put into the internet system, and you'll see they're just plugged in, which means that someone put that machine in there, offered it to the hotel by paying them a dollar a transaction. But they're nothing, it's going nowhere. They just want your card information and your PIN. So it's worth $50 to them that they're going to give you. It has a $50 limit, but for give you $50, it's worth it to get your PIN number and your card number. So you have to be kind of careful of those machines. Again, if you use a credit card, it's kind of irrelevant because you have no liability. But if you used a debit card and they got it out of your bank account, then you have to try and get that money back.
Let's go to the phones here. We'll try to, let's see if I can click on Chris in Portland. Hi, Chris. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have just a quick heads up. This is my second year in business. I'm a landscaper. And my biggest thing that I've seen, and it's happened to me more than a dozen times, is I will either get an email or even a text message where somebody is interested in me doing work for them. I will show up at this person's house. They are not there. Reasons could be as far as I've had people say they're in the hospital or they're out of state right now. And I go to this home, it is for sale, and they obviously tell me they just purchased it. So everything seems okay, but then the last part of the transaction is that I have your bank information so I could route the money to you. Now, I thank God I have a girlfriend who is very good investigator, and she will eventually look for these properties online, find them, and find out through the realtor that they have not been purchased. So that has been a big issue with me, and that actually has wasted a lot of my resources up till now, of course, because I'm smarter.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, you know, scamming is all about getting money or getting information. So in that case, obviously, they want his bank account information so they can do wire transfers and withdraw off of his account. So that was the whole purpose of that whole scam. So who owns the house is kind of irrelevant. They just want to get him there and then get him, just give him that that information. And they do that in many ways. That's one way of doing it. Sometimes they send you a check, and because you endorse the check, they get information off the back of the check, etc.
So Janet, what should Chris then do? Report it to your office?
Sure.
Or the police?
Report it to our office in the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office. Go online at maine.gov/AG/consumer or call 1-800-436-2131 and talk to a complaint examiner.
I have friends who will not read their Social Security number over a cell phone or give a credit card number over a cell phone. Are they wise to do that, or are they overthinking?
Won't give the credit card number over the cell phone.
Yeah.
I guess I am guilty of that myself, using the credit card. I don't give out my Social Security number unless I absolutely have to, if I'm applying for a job or something. But generally speaking, I protest anytime somebody asks me for my Social Security number. And you know that the feds, CMS, are looking at changing the way they connect the Social Security number with the Medicare number now. And hopefully that'll change in the next couple of years, so it won't be as easy to detect somebody's Social Security number from their Medicare card. But yeah, I use my credit card over the phone, cell phone, or landline. You almost have to. But you also want to check your credit report. As Frank was saying earlier, you can go online for free at www.annualcreditreport.com and check. In Maine, you're entitled to check your credit report with the three credit rating agencies, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. You should check them every 4 months. Try, you know, a different one. You can go online and do that, or call the 800 numbers and just to see if there's anything, any red flags. Check your credit card bills every month. Don't just pay them automatically. Look for any weird, unusual charges, something you don't recognize. And if you see something odd, call the credit card company and see what it's about and then dispute it.
And remember that. You know, I find amazing that I'm on Medicare, but obviously I don't collect Social Security yet. So consequently, I have to pay my bill every month, and I pay by check. But it asked me to not only send the check in, but in the memo box put my Social Security number, which would be kind of ridiculous, same way the IRS does when they tell you to mail a payment in. Because if someone were to get that, excuse me, that check, they would have all that information, including my Social Security number. The other thing is, when people say to you, I only need the last four digits of your Social Security number, that is always followed up with, oh, so I see you got a real Southern accent. Oh, yeah, I was born and raised in Alabama. Oh, really? Yeah, you know, you sound like you're my age. I'm 48. Oh, no, I'm a little older than you. I'm 56. Well, you just told them where you were born and your date of birth. That's the first three digits of your Social Security number. So that leaves them only two numbers to manipulate. So you have to be very careful about what kind of information you give away.
Let's go to James in Bucksport. Hi, James. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was just talking with my girlfriend yesterday. She was in Lubeck and got a call. They said they were from the IRS and that she had owed. And she just said, you know, that's no problem about being arrested or whatever, because she did her taxes through H&R Block. But I was wondering, would it do any good to keep the number that they called from and they wanted her to send something through the mail, get the address? Would that be anything that we could turn in so they could actually catch these people?
You can turn it in. You can call the IRS and report these numbers and addresses. But honestly, they change probably every 5 minutes. And I know a lot of people tell me, well, I kept them on the line. I go, no, they kept you on the line. You know, don't. If you play along, you're not gonna help yourself. They'll just call back. They will absolutely call you back and harass you.
And two things to keep in mind there. One, most of these calls come from Russia, China, India. People in their kitchen in their pajamas making these calls, and they do have millions of numbers to switch to. So that's not really going to help you. And remember that most companies that do robocalling, they time those calls. So if I pick up the phone and it says, this is the IRS, I immediately hang up the phone, I'm going to get off their list, because even the list they sell, because I was only on the call for 3 or 4 seconds. If I start listening to their pitch or press prompts, then that's like having somebody on the line.
You
so they're going to sell that. Sucker's on the line. They're going to sell. So the quicker you hang up, the better.
Yeah.
All right, James, thank you. Let's go to Josh in Gardner. Hi, Josh.
Hey, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Yeah, hi. Sorry. I have a question that's more of a legal one. I worked for a company that, to make a long story short, for security reasons with the fleet vehicles they use, they ended up wanting to use the last four digits of everyone's Social Security. The problem I had is when they came out with this, they used everyone's full Social Security, and they faxed to every remote location, and you're talking hundreds of people saw these, everyone's full Social Security number. Keep in mind, only they want you to use the last four. Is that okay to do? Is that legal? That was my only question.
So this is your employer who did this, or a contractor?
Yeah, an employer, yes.
Yeah, that doesn't seem right, and I wouldn't go along with it. I don't know why they need your Social Security number to track a fleet vehicle.
That's what they use. You know, you go get fuel, you get anything on their fleet card, you use the last four of your social. But what they did was they printed everyone's, you know, you're talking hundreds of employees. Now everyone has everyone's social security number full.
Right, and that's just a perfect example of the misuse of the social security number. When I was a kid, first of all, you didn't get a social security number until you got a job, so you were 16, 17 years old. Only three people knew the number, your employer, you, and the government. Now you don't leave the hospital without the number. And people give you all these reasons why they need to have your social security number, while yet under the law, they're very restrictive of where you have to mandatorily give that number. So people shouldn't just give away their number just because they're told to do so. So that's really another example of a great misuse by someone of people's personal information, a social security number.
Well, we're going to give away a number. It's 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We'll take a short break and be right back. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical, and Sweetser, offering the Promise Line for all types of mental health needs, even when school is out. Learn more at sweetser.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guests are Buddhist scholar B. Allen Wallace and theoretical physicist Sean Carroll. The two will debate one of science's and spirituality's most fundamental questions: just what is the nature of reality? That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And you can hear that after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock today.
Public radio is a partnership. Hi, this is Audie Cornish. Maine Public Radio and NPR work together to bring you news coverage unlike anything else on your radio dial. And we're in partnership with you. Each day, we do the best possible job we can to bring you radio that's informative and enjoyable. And in exchange, we ask that you make a contribution. Your contribution is vital because listener support is public radio's most important source of income. Take a moment right now and have your donation count toward the Super Thursday one-day membership drive. The number to call is 1-800-866-1475, or you can give at mainepublic.org.
Back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling, broadcasting live from Hannaford Hall at USM. Today on the program, fraud prevention. With me today, Maine's Attorney General Janet Mills. Also with us, Frank Abagnale. He's an identity theft expert. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go back to the phones to Kevin in Georgetown. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, my question is there anything that can be done after the fact? Now, we didn't know it was going on, but my mother ended up, and somehow we found out through the Bath police that it was Jamaicans that had got a hold of my mom, had by telephone offered her that she was going to get money, and she had to give them money to get money, yada, yada. The end result was she ended up giving them $11,000. And the very last event that happened that got her scared was that they told her they had just she was on the phone with them, and they had just paid the toll in New Hampshire, and we're on their way there, and this is very serious matter, Mrs. And we don't know what we're going to do when we get there if you don't have this. And they were trying to get another $2,600 out of her. Regardless, it all ended. We found out about it. The police were involved, but it's done. It's over.
Her peace of mind is destroyed, and that's a crime. It's terrible to treat people that way, and that's happening every day. Hundreds of times a day in Maine, unfortunately. You ask what can be done. You did the right thing talking to the police department. Now get a hold of the credit agencies and make sure that her credit is okay. Change her bank account. Go online with identitytheft.gov, and they'll give you tips about protecting her from future losses.
And remember that, unfortunately, once you lose your money, you're never going to get your money back. They may catch the person. They may send them to jail for 20 years. But you're not going to get your money back, so you don't want to part your money that easily.
Do you think would Kevin's mother be targeted specifically? In other words, do they have information about her that says she's of a certain age or she lives alone, or is it random?
No, most of the time it's random, but you have to also understand, now I'm not on Facebook or any social media at all whatsoever, but when you're on Facebook, you know, people tell people a lot of things, their children's names, their grandchildren's names, pictures of their children, where they were born, what their date of birth was, where they're going on vacation, where they came from, what kind of car they drive. There's so much information that can be obtained from those social media sites that, yes, when they do call and about your grandson, they're going to use your grandson's name because they know who your grandson is. They probably even know where your grandson goes to school, so they might be saying they're calling from where his college town is. They can make it very personable because we give them so much information to do that with.
And people are generally friendly also, right? They were raised to talk about where they grew up and when they went to college or high school. And
we're very trusting, especially in Maine, I think. We're
yes.
a trusting population and a graying population, the oldest state in the nation percentage-wise. And people should be trusting, but trust and verify, right? She's a victim merely because she answered the phone.
Let's go to Carly in Camden. Hi, Carly.
Hi. I have college-age kids, and they use almost exclusively Venmo. And they're like, Mom, just pay me on Venmo. All their friends pay them on Venmo. I'm just wondering how safe that is.
Again, it all depends who's running Venmo, how much internal security they have, what are their technologies used to keep that information safe. I always don't like relying on that third party. I would rather have my liability removed by the third party. So in my case, I'd rather just, give my children. Well, one of the things I did with my sons is when they turned 18 and got ready to go off to college, I applied for a credit card in their name. It was their card. Because they were only 18 and had no credit, I guaranteed the card. So that did three things. One, they had to send the bill to me, and I was responsible for the bill, so I knew how they were spending their money each month. Two, I set the limit on that card. And three, every month that I paid that bill, the credit went on their credit. So by the time they got to college, they had a credit score in the 800s. They could buy a house, buy a car, buy a condo, whatever they needed. They didn't need me to co-sign. So over those 4 years, I actually built credit for themselves. And that's very important. Credit is not what credit was 30 years ago, where you only got credit to get a loan or buy a car. Today, credit is used for everything. If you apply for a job, they're going to check your credit. You apply for life insurance, they're checking your credit. You apply for auto insurance, they're going to check your credit. Credit is used to establish the character of yourself, whether you pay your bills on time, says a lot about you as an individual. So we try to teach young people at a very early age to start building that credit. What happens a lot of times, these kids live off of debit cards and Venmo. Then they graduate, they go to get a job, they go to rent an apartment, and the manager says, sir, you don't have any credit. You don't have a credit file with the credit bureau, so we're going to need your parents to co-sign the lease. Well, this way you do it on your own because you've spent that 4 years building your credit.
Carly, does that help?
Yes. Yeah, I guess. Venmo is kind of like Facebook for kids. They have to use it because all their friends are using it, and they don't handle cash. They and you can go on their like their Venmo page and it says, okay, Emma had beers with Joe and paid for it. You know, I mean, it's very strange. It's very different, but it seems to be the way of the future.
So that's because and scam artists love that. Yeah. young people are so naive that's why they're able to be so successful at what they do.
All right, Carly, best of luck. Let's go to Melissa in Topsom. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I had a question about the Social Security numbers. I'm in my 50s, and I applied for a job recently, and I was shocked that the application was like four pages long, and it was for a graphic design job. And a couple of things they wanted to know was my credit history and my Social Security number, neither of which I didn't fill out. Obviously, I didn't get the job either, but I wanted to know, like, what's that about? You know, I feel very uncomfortable giving someone my Social Security number. They haven't even hired me or anything. They're just interviewing me.
Yeah, I am. I believe I have a policy that I will fill out the application, but I will not provide you my Social Security number until you actually offer me a job. Most of the time they're asking your Social Security number, and if you read the fine print on the bottom of the application where you signed, you are giving them rights to do background checks, including checking your credit. So when you signed that and you gave them your Social Security number, that allowed them the ability to access your credit and see your credit report. And again, they're looking at credit to see how you pay your bills, whether you have judgments, tax liens against you, etc. So if I was hiring someone to handle money, I'd be very leery if they had tax liens against them, gambling debts against them, and things of that nature. So people are going to do that, and that's why you just have to be a little more careful about what you do.
But a graphics designer job, you wouldn't think that you'd need a credit check.
They probably use a standard application for hiring all employees.
I wouldn't give them that either.
Let's go to Joyce in Portland. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I have a question. I recently got scammed. Major. My bank says there's absolutely nothing they can do. So where do I go for help, for information? What numbers, what sources, do I go to a lawyer? What do I do?
You can, Joyce, you can call our office at 1-800-436-2131. Excuse me, and report it. Talk to a complaint examiner. We'll take a report, see if we can do anything about it, and we'll at least collect the information and try to help you avoid this kind of thing in the future. And we often report these things in the aggregate to the FTC, sometimes the Department of Justice or the IRS when that's involved. So we welcome your call.
Is there anything that can be done or is being done to aid in trying to track and prosecute this?
Sure, and occasionally there are successful prosecutions. We just don't want people to get their hopes up by thinking that if they keep a scammer on the line or email them back and forth, that they're going to be their own private investigator and break through this scam, because honestly, these people take so much time inventing these scams, you wonder why they can't just find a job. But it'll be easier, but there's good money in it. Just last fall, there was an investigation that resulted in the arrest of 20 people in the United States, and I think 30-something scammers who were running a call scam out of India. It was part of the IRS scam. After those arrests, they're still pending trial, I believe. The number of IRS scams went down for a while, but they're kind of surging upwards again given the tax season upon us.
I would add that I've had the opportunity over my career to work with all of the state attorney generals, and that is where I tell everyone to call, because the state attorney general represents the citizens of that state, and he or she are most concerned with the problems and issues they have. So even better than the local police or the local sheriff or anyone, the state attorney general has the consumer protection agency. They have investigators. They're more apt to do something about it, and they're also more apt to make sure it doesn't happen again or get the word out or do something about it to prevent it. So that would always be my first call if I felt I've been scammed or someone. And the other only thing I would add to that, anyone can be scammed, including myself.
Yep.
So you should never be embarrassed that someone has ripped you off or taken your money. Unfortunately, sometimes people won't even share that with their family because they think, well, that was a stupid mistake I made. I'm not going to tell the police or tell my family or loved ones. And that's the wrong approach. You're just allowing them to do that to somebody else. So I can be scammed. Anybody can be scammed. There's nothing to be ashamed of if you've been ripped off or scammed by somebody.
Some of them are just very convincing. Yeah. And if you don't catch yourself, you can.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think you're going to scam the scammer. But they very intelligent and well-educated people have fallen prey to these scams and lost tens of thousands of dollars.
Let's go to Kevin in Auburn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. My mother-in-law some years ago was scammed in a very odd way. She had a soft spot for animals, and so she would get these things for animal charity, many, many of them. And she would write small checks to these charities, and she would forget that she'd written them a check. They would send them out every few weeks, and they all looked exactly the same. And there were three or four of these charities, and we looked at her checkbook at one point and realized she'd written out thousands of dollars as little checks to these different organizations. They might have been real, but they were doing this on purpose, and we put a stop to it.
Yeah, good. There is the Office of Professional Licensing and Professional Regulation in Maine keeps a list of the registered charities who are licensed to do business in Maine. It's always a good thing to check that. I only give money to charities that I really know and trust, usually local charities.
Nissa has a question via email. Hi, Frank. Thanks so much for visiting Maine. Do you have any insight into mortgage fraud?
Oh.
Yeah, there's mortgage fraud on, especially we've come through a whole period of mortgage fraud in the last 10 years or so. And it's, again, done on both sides. It's the mortgage company who's defrauding the individual, having them claim that they make more money than they actually do to get a loan that they're not capable eventually paying. And then there are individuals who sometimes may have three or four mortgages on the same house because they've swindled a number of mortgage companies into believing they're the first lien holder. But you can go online to the National Mortgage Association, and they show you a list of all the current scams that people are using to in the mortgage area. But there are so many different scams based around on both sides of the person granting the mortgage and the person trying to get a mortgage.
Also, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington, and here in Maine, the Bureau of Consumer Credit Protection, Will Lund, who's here with us today.
There's about a minute left, so you can each get your 30-second pitch on what to do to protect yourself from fraud. Janet, you can go first.
Check your credit report every year, at least, if not more frequently, at annualcreditreport.com. You don't need to pay for a credit report. Check your bills regularly. Go over them with a fine-tooth comb. Don't just send a check out or pay them by credit card or otherwise. Be skeptical. Talk to somebody you trust. If you get a weird call and you're not sure about it, or a weird email from somebody which sounds real, looks real, you know, don't be too trusting. Verify and tell somebody else. Don't wire money. That's a big red flag. These scam artists almost always ask you to wire money, or now use Green Dot or PayPal, one of those things. Don't wire money. That's a big red flag.
Good. Frank?
Yeah, I think just common sense. You know, you don't pay for something in advance you haven't received, or I'm sending you so much money, send me so much money back. All of these things are answered in that very simple word of verify. It only takes a couple of minutes to verify something, and that's the biggest key I've found to helping people deal with all of these issues. If they just take a moment to verify that it was the IRS that sent them the letter, the IRS that made the phone call, whatever the scam is. If you make it easy for someone to steal from you, and it's unfortunate, but chances are someone will. So you got to be a little smarter, a little wiser consumer today than you did 20 years ago.
Janet Mills, Frank Abagnale, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Keith.
Janet Mills is Maine's Attorney General. Frank Abagnale is an identity theft expert and one of the world's most respected authorities on forgery, embezzlement, and secure documents. He's working with AARP Fraud Watch Network to help people learn how to spot and avoid scams. John Keimel ran the board today. We had technical help today from Dan Works and John Bradford. Sam Dearen answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me as we take the show on the road again, this time to the campus of Bowdoin College, for a conversation about Maine and the environment. If you happen to be in the Brunswick area tomorrow, come check out the show. We'll be broadcasting from Smith Auditorium. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.